and welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, I'll be talking big budgets and giant action sequences with Transformers director Michael Bay. And from big and brash to small and creepy, I'll be talking to debut director Johnny Kevorkian about his inner city London horror, The Disappeared. Zan Brooks is back with me in the pod to discuss Nick Moran's debut film, Telstar. We'll be looking at New York indie Gigantic and Hitchcock's restored classic, North by Northwest. Yes, you know, it's the Optimus Prime of podcasts. It's Film Weekly. This week sees the UK release of the next instalment of the Transformers adventures. It's subtitled Revenge of the Fallen, which is apt as the director, Michael Bay, has been using the Transformer franchise to reinstate his blockbuster credentials, which took a right hit after the flops that were The Island and Pearl Harbor. This time, Bay is on a winner, and with hot young talent like Shia LaBeouf and Megan Fox and special effects primed to kick Terminator out of the ballpark, Transformers looks to be taking over the global box office. So when I met up with Michael Bay, I asked him what motivated his obvious fervour for the futuristic. But before we hear from Michael Bay, let's get a short fix of the Transformers.
Hello? Michaela.
I can't believe you're going to stand me up on our first web chat date.
I just had a full-blown mental meltdown. I am seeing symbols ever since I...
Since what?
Ever since I touched the cube splitter. Do you have it?
Yeah, I have it. It's in the shop safe. It's fine.
Michaela, do not touch it, okay? Don't touch it.
I'm not gonna touch it. Sam, it's fine. It's locked away. No one knows where it is.
I do.
Yeah, well, what's fun about Transformers, it's kind of the... we all have a kid in us, and there's, again, the wish fulfillment thing, and making people believe these robots are real. I remember when I did the first one, people were amazed how realistic they were, and I got the comment over and over. It's like when I first time I saw Jurassic Park.
Yeah. And I was reminded of that. Your little robots, in particular, remind me of the little ones, the Prestige, the bigger ones in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Is that a Spielberg? Because Spielberg, you work with him. Obviously.
Yeah, but it's not like he's. I mean, he's not writing the scenes or anything like that. So,
but there's a sensibility.
But Steven, what he's great at is inspiring me to like with Jurassic Park. He said, "You know how many effect shots I had?" I said, "Maybe 200." He goes, "56, really 56." So, when I do effects, there's some directors who will put 1,000, 2,000 effects into a movie. When your movie's running like 3,500 shots, you know. Transformers 1, we had 400, maybe 500 effect shots, where you put it on the screen, so it's more bang for the buck, and you can use more complex shots.
You're clearly a director who loves his shots, that loves the technique of movies. But I wonder what about the message when I talk about futurism and stuff? What the actual sort of message that remains of the movie? Are you hopeful for humanity in that?
Absolutely hopeful for humanity. I mean, my movies almost all deal with heroism and sacrificing oneself for the greater good.
Yeah.
So if you look through all of them, that's what they're saying.
Because I felt that the first Transformers, maybe because it was going to lead on to the next one, there was a sort of a future of uncertainty. Machines were rising.
No, it's not. It's not dark like that. This is the first Transformers. To me, it was purely the charm of a kid hiding an alien robot in his backyard.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that earlier today we were talking, and you said that you weren't even sure after the first one that you would work again. The risk.
Well, I mean, I know I'm going to work
again.
It's just you put yourself out there when you're trying a movie like this.
Yeah.
That's not your staple of like a Spider-Man.
Yeah, no, I mean, but when you have the pressure of a Hollywood movie like this, such a vast amount of people, such a vast amount of money, such a vast amount of studio time and money, mm-hmm. is there an extra pressure? Do you already think, well,
it's
do you
absolutely
know what?
Pressure. I mean, people don't understand when you're spending $150 million and then you're marketing it for another $100 million, there's a lot of pressure. So it's like you're like a CEO running a huge operation.
Yeah.
You've got 2,000 people that are working under you, and you surround yourself with a great team. But, you know, I really, it's about leadership and how you guide your team, and you want everyone to be creative and add to it, and that's the fun of movies.
Yeah.
You know?
This is where you get the reputation of the on-set tyrant, which is a bit
of
an old
school. I need to clarify that, because I shoot very efficiently, very fast. remember, by the time I was 29, I've shot over 500 days, okay? I know everyone's job, backwards and forwards. I know how to shoot camera. I know how to light. I know when DPs are slowing down. And there's a lot of waste in Hollywood. And I love coming under budget on my movies. And there's a lot of dicking around time. And I try to cut the waste and spend it with the actors and keep the sets alive and move and only shoot 12-hour days. And the actors really like that because it energizes them. Because there's nothing worse than shooting one side and they sit in their trailer for 3 hours. Okay, it's you can really see it in their performances, yeah. And the crews like it. And I must say, I get that reputation because I'm basically an AD on my own set. Okay.
So you're doing the shouting and the
I'm telling them we're going here, yeah. We're going here, we're leapfrogging over here, and you know, when I because I produce other directors now,
yeah.
And I try to explain to them the leapfrogging thing, and they're like, "What does that mean?" And it's just you've got to know exactly where you're going, four steps ahead of everyone else.
Isn't this what the old Hollywood greats did, the DeMilles,
well,
the
Preminges?
Well,
they would, yeah, they would, you know, but their equipment was a lot slower, you
yes, know? Absolutely. Is there a time, I know you take these things quite personally, when the actual reviews, I mean, Pearl Harbor, you took quite
well,
hard.
Well, you shouldn't read the good ones, you shouldn't read the bad ones, and the way I look at it, I mean, my movies have grossed, like, I think $3 billion or something, yeah, like that, and it just, I'm making entertainment, and that's who I'm making for people, mm-hmm. And I'm not making it for a critic.
Do you ever want to do? Do you ever say, want to say?
Absolutely.
Well, you know what,
I have so many different types of movies that I'd like to make. You know,
so you could make a small two-hander art house kind of.
I would
gym.
Love to do that. You know, from documentaries to, you know, this has been a chapter in my life, and I'm definitely going to move into other chapters. Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, a couple of days ago, I asked Ken Loach if someone ever gave him 150 million quid, would he go and make? Could he make Transformers?
Right.
He said he wouldn't know what to do with
right.
that money. So someone said, "Well, you've only got 10 million. Well, you've got 5 million."
Well, I would figure out a way to do something.
Yeah. Would that be like a holiday from you know?
You know, believe it or not, it's when you spend 18 months on this and you the vast. I mean, this one we probably had 2,500 people, and you just. It was a very fun movie to make, and I really liked the animation process of it, which was new for me, you know, character animation. But it would be a relief to just work with just actors in a room or a small movie. I've got several small movies that I'm working on right now, and it's kind of a breath of fresh air.
Well, big or small, whatever the next one is, do come back in the director's chair. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Very interesting indeed. Michael Bay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We don't often have huge, big-budget blockbuster directors on this auteurist-slanted show, so my thanks to Michael Bay for coming in to the pod, and Transformers Revenge of the Fallen hits the big screens here in the UK this Friday, the 9th of June, and you can see a video version, a longer version of this interview by going to guardian.co.uk in the director's chair. Transformer like himself, Zan Brooks, has gone from normal citizen into film critic and has entered the pod and joins me now to review this week's films. Welcome back, Zan.
I'm still in metamorphosis mode here, but we'll get to the final stage.
Are you or are you not a robot in disguise?
Would I tell you if I were?
I don't know. Well, you tell me in the voice of someone I don't understand.
I think that there'd be little giveaway signals, wouldn't there? There'd be sort of flashing eyes and perhaps turning into a car mid podcast.
The Transformers, did you remember them as a toy? Was that your era?
I don't think it was. I think I was a little past it,
yeah, me
by
too.
Then. So it didn't really appeal to me then, and you know, it doesn't appeal to me now.
Funny that.
It's weird, isn't it?
Who do you think it does appeal to?
Morons, I think. I think that's the demographic.
There's a lot
it's
of
going
them,
for.
Though.
There's a hell of a lot of morons out there. People
yeah.
are the worst, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's not particularly our demographic here on the podcast. I think it's probably 12, 13-year-old boys.
Do you know the other demographic that I think this may appeal to is the deaf? Because it is quite the loudest film I think I've seen
yeah.
all year.
Do you think it's louder than Terminator Salvation?
I think it was a bit louder than that. I think it's taking it up to 11.
I think it probably is. So we'll leave Transformers there. I mean, I very much enjoyed talking to Michael Bay, and I hosted a press conference with him, and I asked Megan Fox, who's like the hottest woman in the world, apparently.
She runs very well in slow motion.
Doesn't she? She does a lot of it as well.
It's great technique.
And I asked her how she got the part, and she said, I went to Michael Bay's house and he made me wash his Ferrari. and do a screen test.
That's the modern day casting couch, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. I said, well, where's that footage? Because I don't know what happened to it. And he's like, well, I don't know where it is. I don't know. You know where it is. It's, yeah. it's by his bed.
Now, that's a DVD extra that people would pay.
You see? That's the Transformers for our demographic, Zan. Let's move swiftly on to something a little more of a different ilk and different pace. Let's review Telstar, which is the directing debut of Nick Moran. He of Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. It's the story of Joe Meek, a producer who, on the Holloway Road in the 1960s, reinvented the role of the music producer and thus reinvented the pop single.
Tighter, tighter. Right, let's stop, man. Stop, stop, stop. I want 8 bars of that. Twice.
We never had this trouble with Johnny Kidd.
I'll bet.
Never recorded over a handbag shop.
Yeah, it's unusual, isn't it?
Always used to have to wear a suit to the studio.
Riveting.
Get on with it!
Joe Meek being played by Con O'Neill. It stars James Corden, J.J. Field, Carl Barrett of the Libertines. This was a risk for Nick Moran, directing and writing the script. Did it pay off?
I think it kind of did, really. I think that, you know, Nick Moran is perhaps sort of unfairly dismissed as the sort of preening poster boy of sort of Guy Ritchie movies. But if this had been any other director, I think we'd have said this was a perfectly serviceable film debut.
Yeah.
It's a little bit lightweight. It perhaps lacks a little kind of depth and punch. And Meek is such a sort of fascinating character. He's this real sort of flawed genius, and this traces his kind of rise and fall. And I would have liked to have seen a little bit more behind the kind of the scenes and behind the sort of surfaces. But the surfaces of this film are great, and it did convince me, and it did have a very pungent sense of that kind of unglamorous post-war, really, London, and the sort of the birth of kind of British pop music.
Absolutely, because it's a world that's going from black and white to colour. Mm. And I like the kind of Joe Orton-esque kind of farce element of it.
Yeah.
It was kind of directed in a sort of different way. I've thought Nick Moran, having sort of grown up on the Guy Ritchie set, would have done fast cutting, yeah, like pop music-y editing. He doesn't really do all that, actually.
No, and at times it almost looks like one of those kind of old BBC Two play, you know, teleplays that you sort of saw. They kind of died out a bit in the 1990s, but I remember a couple of them then. And that's kind of good and bad.
Yeah.
It has a kind of quietness and you engage with it, and perhaps it lacks a little kind of fireworks and pyrotechnics.
Yeah, absolutely. Although it does start, I like the kind of 60s montages, yeah, the mini skirts, the Carnaby Street. I thought that was all well done, even though I've seen it 1,000 times.
Sure.
It actually sort of worked really nicely.
And Meek is a sort of
London
forgotten figure.
Yeah.
And he is the sort of kind of missing link kind of character. You know, everybody sort of fastens on the Beatles, but he was kind of, he was almost anticipating the sort of rise of psychedelia with these sort of strange sounds. He was a sort of an RAF radio whiz who kind of turned that into pop music.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating bit of kind of archaeology, really, this
and sort of, and lo-fi as well, because he went in this studio above this band,
yeah,
shop
above on the Holloway Road, yeah.
You know, and he was just playing with knobs and fiddles, and then the people in the bathroom were singing the soprano,
yeah, so
in
so
the
as
toilet.
Well, as anticipating psychedelia, he's also anticipating the rise of sort of dance music and DJ culture, where you could kind of make music on your laptop.
Yeah,
so he was a proper pioneer.
Yeah, and I was sort of convinced by Con O'Neill's performance of him as a sort of flawed genius. I was a little less convinced of the sort of spark and chemistry. I think the sort of the script and the budget eventually show, and eventually I was like, oh, let them get out of this room. However, the film was,
yes,
sort of a claustrophobic.
Well, it was based on a stage play, I think. There was a James Hicks stage play, and sometimes it sort of betrays its sort of stage origins.
But I thought everyone was quite good, and yes, there were some nice figures in it. There was Chaz Hodges from Chaz and Dave, he kind of pops up in it.
Nice supporting role from Kevin Spacey as well, as his sort of army boss sort of backer.
Yeah, who invented, it was in plastic, so it was very good for inventing,
yeah,
vinyl. I thought it was an interesting world, and well, it was pretty well conjured up.
Mm.
That's Telstar by Nick Moran. Another shift of pace and shift of location. We'll go to New York, Zan, for an indie film this week. Gigantic, starring Paul Dano and Zooey Deschanel. Is it Zoe or Zooey? Who knows? John Goodman also pops up. It's an indie, quirky comedy of two young people falling in love in the Big Apple.
I've got your receipt here and all the paperwork for the bed. You just need to tell me when to deliver it.
Wait a minute. I had this fucked up dream. I was in a cave and my hair was made out of marijuana, and then my swim coach was, are you adopting a dog?
No.
Oh, you were in my dream. Do you ever incorporate things into your dreams? I was out of it. What were we talking about?
delivery? When do you want it?
No. You were on the phone. You're talking about something. What were you talking about?
I'm in the process of adopting a baby from China. Oh, I don't have the baby yet.
Oh?
Yeah, you have to go through a shit ton of tests and interviews, and there are a few categories where I'm not an ideal candidate.
Do you mind me asking why?
Not at all. I'm not married, and I'm 28.
Well, Zan, quirky or too quirky?
I think this was a little too quirky for me. It's a film that is very much in love with its sort of source material. Its source material being, you know, the films are sort of Hal Ashby, and the sort of the slightly kind of kookier end of the indie spectrum. And I kind of love those films too. But there's a sense that in that kind of oddball, eccentric way, they're getting at kind of human truths.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it felt like just a sort of style tick, really.
It was. It quirky is really difficult, I think, to
quirky
do.
Is difficult.
Because you mentioned Hal Ashby, and then we go through to Hal Hartley.
Yeah.
And I think even Hal Hartley, when it started, I quite liked old Adrian Shelley. And then by the end of his...
It gets too mannered, doesn't
yeah.
it? And this was very, very mannered. And also I'm starting to have problems with Zooey/Zooey Deschanel, who I loved when she started out in films like All the Real Girls
yeah.
and a supporting role in The Good Girl.
And Elf.
And Elf, forget. Even Elf. She was great in Elf. But she's become the sort of Holly-go-lightly of the American indie scene. So she's the sort of the little wide-eyed ingenue princess. And she's playing that tune a bit too much.
Doesn't she pixie in as soon as she comes in? I mean, I kind of actually warmed to her a bit by the end of the film, but at the beginning I was like, oh, don't do this, Zooey/Zooey, whoever you are. She was just kind of pixieing about with her big moony eyes.
And of course she's
adorable,
supposed to fall in love with her. And yes, she's beautiful, and yes, she is talented, and yet she's got to expand her repertoire a little.
Yeah, that's what I think so. However, I did kind of like this story of sort of what goes on in those new Soho lofts down in downtown New York, those kind of weird...
Do you think this really
people.
Is what goes on?
I've got a feeling
Soho.
It sort
really?
Of is what happens, and it's not a world that I've been let into, but I think that there are rich art collectors with bad backs who go out for dinner, and there's a cross of families, and I think that maybe it happens.
Maybe.
Well, God, I had to watch that rubbish... What was that rubbish film recently? Mama's Man.
Oh, yeah.
That lo-fi film by that bloke, Andrew Jablowski, whatever, and his parents were artists down there.
Yeah,
I mean,
the whole mumblecore
rubbish.
Thing.
Everyone's mumblecore. I couldn't bloody answer that word. At least that wasn't... This is quirklecore, but I preferred
yes.
that.
Yes, and you're right. It kind of improves. And I thought the last scene was moving in the way that you wanted the whole film to be moving.
There's also a very strange kind of motif that runs through it with Zach Galifianakis, who was last week in The Hangover, did this great breakthrough performance. I'd never seen him before. And of course, in the way that happens in American stars, you've never seen him before, then they're in every film for the next four
yeah.
months. He pops up again as this kind of homeless, trampy person who keeps beating our lead, Paul Dano, up. And I don't know why. And I don't know if that really worked for me.
It didn't work for me at all. I felt that this was actually the real pretentious bit of the film. That I think you're supposed to see him as a manifestation of Paul Dano's demons who he has to defeat, but it felt very pretentious and heavy-handed. And yeah, you're supposed to kind of think, is it real, is it fake? And actually, the whole film in the end felt a bit fake to me.
As that, it's a little bit posy, isn't it? I did love seeing Ed Asner, who of course was in Elf as well, with Zooey Deschanel as Papa Elf.
Yes, and then he's in the Pixar's Up, which is upcoming.
Yes, of course, he's the narrator of that. As he's the old man in Up, and also nice to see Jane Alexander as Paul Dano's mum, Oscar winner.
All of the cast are actors that I like, and I'm very predisposed to like whatever they're in, and this tested that.
Yeah, it did. Gigantic. It's a leap, but maybe you could make it. People might like it. They might just fall in love with it, Zan, if they're quirkily disposed.
If they're little wide-eyed princesses.
Let's move on to something that I'm sure no one can dislike. It is a re-release. This summer is good for whenever there's a big, big blockbuster like Transformers and everyone runs scared and says, oh, no, we can't get into cinemas because they're full of 12-year-olds. We do get the little re-releases. We've had so far the brilliant Accident. We've had Spartacus. And now this week we get Hitchcock back in glorified print, a BFI release, North by Northwest. Cary Grant on the run from that plane.
Hot day.
Seen worse.
Are you supposed to be meeting someone here?
Waiting for the bus. Due any minute.
Oh.
Some of them crop duster pilots get rich. They live long enough.
Then your name isn't Kaplan.
Can't say it is, because it ain't. Here she comes, right on time. That's funny.
What?
That plane's dusting crops where there ain't no crop.
The
Is that a classic, deservedly so?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think sometimes this is sort of unfair. It's become very fashionable to say this isn't one of the great Hitchcocks because it's kind of lightweight and it's a thriller, and so it's not Psycho and it's not Vertigo, which are the two films that kind of bookended it. But actually, in its way, I think that this is as dark and strange and complicated as those two films.
Oh, right, because I mean, it's very interesting because I love the wittiness, the lightness of touch, the kind of suaveness, the cocktails, the Gibsons.
It has all that.
Yeah.
It has all that. It has all that kind of modernist sheen to it, and it looks great, and it has that lightness of touch. But it's also, in typical Hitchcock fashion, a film of dark pockets and moral relativism, and the fact that the Cary Grant character is Roger O. Thornhill, and the O stands for nothing, and he's an advertising executive who's mistaken for another person who's a bit of a construct,
yep,
is this strange thing of identity, and that we're all just basically kind of constructs. And there's a great scene where he gets into the hotel room of the person that they think he is and finds all the row of suits, and the suggestion is that we're all just a row of suits.
Yes,
and so it has that strangeness to it.
And of course the climax, which is of course on Mount Rushmore, which is on icons. You know, it's
yes,
on simulacra.
Yeah.
So one can be very psychological about this film, I think, too. And there is the typical kind of the romance with Eve Marie Saint, who's the typical Hitchcockian blonde.
Yeah, and the duplicity. Yeah, exactly. Yes, the person who might be the salvation or might be the devil.
Yes.
And you just don't know.
Yeah, I love James Mason in this.
Yes, James Mason is great. And Martin Landau looking incredibly young.
Isn't he scary?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's this kind of homoerotic subtext as well, because Martin Landau's in love with him. But there are great jokes throughout the film as well. There's car chases. There's drink driving, which
there's drink driving. There's the classic bad mum. Hitchcock loves his bad mums, and Cary Grant.
Oh, Roger,
as you know, the ultimate ball breaking mother in this. You know, as opposed to the one in Psycho, who was probably very nice, but it was Norman Bates' interpretation of her.
There's a lovely line in it. He goes where he says, "Oh, that's so horribly sad. How is it that I feel like laughing?" And that is kind of North by Northwest.
There's great lines in it, and it's, you know, there's the classic ingredients. There's the Bernard Herrmann score. There's the fantastic Saul Bass opening credit sequence. So this is probably, I would put it, top five Hitchcocks.
Right, that's not bad.
That's not bad. Hitchcock. I mean, you know, I don't think any other director quite had the strike rate of great films at Hitchcock.
Billy, do you think so? If you had a Hitchcock and a Billy Wilder and a Woody Allen, because they can all kind of boast top fives
they
that
could,
are hard to separate.
Well, they could, yeah. And you throw Bergman in there too, and yeah.
Good top fives.
That's the Premier League
of
filmmakers.
Scorsese
just
can do
about.
A top five and squeeze. Yeah.
Just about.
Yeah. Who else can do a top five? Goddard. I don't think Goddard can do five.
No,
great.
No. Howard Hawks, maybe?
Hawks can do five. That are great. Yeah.
Yeah, these are the titans, aren't
yeah.
they?
We're going to do this one day. We're going to
yeah,
put them
let's
in.
Do
if
it.
You can only get five, that's it. But certainly Hitchcock can. And
yes.
You think this is fifth?
I think this is in the top five. I would put it along with Psycho, maybe The Birds, Vertigo, and Notorious.
Notorious. I'm a big fan of Notorious.
Yeah, Notorious.
As well.
Possibly my favourite.
Yeah, that's got good drink driving in it as well.
It has, hasn't it? Cary Grant is a good drink driver.
Well done, Cary.
Such a thing be possible.
Zan, lovely to see you. North by Northwest. Is that a recommendation of the week?
I think it has to be, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And you can read all of Zan Brooks's musings on film and literature on guardian.co.uk/film. Now, in recent years, the eerie urban horror has been the preserve of Japanese filmmakers such as Hideo Nakata's The Ring or his Dark Water or Takashi Miike with Audition. But with the release of the feature debut of director Johnny Kevorkian, The Disappeared, it seems the British are not shy of giving this genre a run for its money. The film stars rising talent Harry Treadaway, features Alex Jennings and Greg Wise, and also a turn from Tom Felton, who's Draco Malfoy in the Harry Potter series. And I spoke to its director, Johnny Kevorkian, to find out more about why he went to this genre. Johnny, are you a big horror freak then?
The thing with horror was, is that as a sort of first-time director in the UK, I think you could get away with making it cheaper than anything else, really. And I think it's kind of an easier kind of format to go out and shoot it on. Really, if there's no money available, you can shoot it on a sort of handheld camera.
This is kind of rooted very much in reality. Just tell us a bit the plot of it. Pitch it to me as if you were trying to get it made.
It's a ghost story set on a London council estate. That's the kind of, in a few words, it's primarily a drama in the sense of it's a character-driven drama with, you know, strong, believable characters. It's about a father and son relationship and the kind of it's all the kind of dealings with guilt and dealings with what happened with the sort of the brother going missing as a result of the son and the father blaming him. So there's a lot of sort of drama there as well, and then the horror starts to come through.
It reminded me in the best, because I'm not a big horror fan actually, but what I do like are psychological ghost stories, and I think that they're rather sort of touching. And it reminded me of Hideo Nakata's Dark Water, which is my favourite Japanese horror film. Brilliant. Of all time. It reminded me of Don't Look Now as well. Yeah. But I love the fact that you transported that kind of red coated girl from Venice. They've become kind of hoodies in the council set, and I think we see them all. I think London is populated by ghostly hoodies.
It's playing on your sort of modern day fears, I think, of people, that is a growing concern in society. And we thought, well, with that mixed in with a ghost story, I thought, well, you know, it just gives the whole film a sort of base of reality, really, I think. And that's what it was, I think. And those films were big influences, to be honest. I mean, Don't Look Now is a fantastic film, and I'm a big fan of traditional horror films, that I think people aren't as making as much as they should be now. And I think a lot of it is kind of, you know, the gore stuff and the kind of splatterfest, and I think there's a lot of that happening now. And I just wanted to go back and make something, you know, simple that works, you know, with traditional scares.
Yeah, where did you shoot it, Johnny? Because it looks for all the world like a council estate that I've seen. Is it a South London one?
It is. It's Ellison Castle's Haygate.
Yeah.
And it's being boarded up now.
Well, I was going to say, that's just an interesting landmark because it's just about to disappear, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So I thought, well, there we go. We captured a bit of history there, so it's quite interesting, you know, good or bad history, but it's there. And I just thought visually it looked amazing.
What's it like shooting in a place like that? And presumably you're going to attract a lot of the residents and a lot of the hoodies that you're slightly demonising, or they're going to be kind of hanging around, aren't they?
Well, it's interesting because it's quite funny. There were two parts of the estate. There was a good part and a bad part, and unfortunately we were shooting the bad part most of the time. So, because it looked more interesting visually. So, but yeah, the residents were fantastic, and I think they were just really helpful. And once the word got out that Malfoy, Tom Felton was in the film, who played Malfoy, Harry Potter, we had all the kids just turning up on the estate and just watching a shooting. So that was great.
Yeah, you did really well. You got a really good young cast, because there you are. I mean, I was thinking, who is this kid? I've seen him before, but I couldn't work. I mean, he doesn't look anything like he does in the Harry Potter. Great kind of to get him. Great to get Georgia Groom, Greg, who was great in Angus Thongs, and then so was great in London to Brighton. And of course, your star, Harry Treadaway, who, you know, is a really rising star. He's also in another sort of council estate film this year called Fish Tank, which is up at Edinburgh.
That's right.
How did you manage to get this cast together?
Well, I think the script really helped it, I think, because I know for someone like Harry, actually all of the cast had never been in a horror film. There was that appeal, really, I think, that they could still play out the drama and have a serious story there, but yet still make it interesting visually as well and play out the horror as well.
Yeah, he's very good in it, Harry, because he's in it all the time. I mean, it's the best, biggest performance he's given so far as well. So
it is. I think he's about 96% of the time on screen. It's phenomenal, and it carries the whole movie, to be honest.
Johnny, so you got your star. Where did you get the money to make a film like this? You've got a lot of filmmakers who listening to the show, aspiring filmmakers. How do you get it together? I mean, horror's going to, you know, it's always going to make its money back, a bit of horror, but how did you get the funding?
We basically got it. We just went out and found private investors, and pretty much one investor led to another, and it kind of escalated from that, really snowballed from that into kind of the funding, you know, which is great. So, and as soon as we got the money, we just went out and shot it. We didn't even sort of stop to think about it. So it was sort of funded by sort of private sort of backers.
Right. Well, so people can find these people out there. You've got to be resourceful, I suppose.
Yes, you do. I think you've got to be resourceful. And I think you've got to also prove yourself a bit, because there was a short film we'd made before that kind of proved that, you know, gave them more comfort, I think, in their investment. And, you know, and it wasn't a massive budget. So that was, again, it wasn't a huge amount if, you know, the film didn't succeed. But
yeah, well, I think it's extremely effective. I enjoyed it, and I thought this is the sort of film I like, and it was great to see the sort of London Council Estate using the way that those Japanese J-horrors have used their buildings so well. And Candyman, which is a great kind of Council Estate, kind of a New York kind of high-rise frightener, which is one of the scariest films I've ever seen, and yours reminded me of that. So that's great. So congratulations, Johnny Kevorkian. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jason. Good to talk to you.
Cheers. The Disappeared is screening as part of the New British Cinema section at the ICA here in London from this Friday, the 19th of June. For more information, go to their website, ica.org.uk. That's all for this week. I'm off up to the Edinburgh Film Festival, so I'll be bringing you the flavour of that on next week's podcast. Don't forget to do the things we tell you to do every week now. Go and buy The Observer on Sunday. I'm sitting in for the great Philip French, so you can read my reviews of all the week's releases, plus reviews from Edinburgh's opening night. Join us on Facebook. Film Weekly is there. Film Weekly Fans is our group. And we're on Twitter, Film Weekly. That's us. Join us there too. Let us know what you think. This week's podcast featured the score from Gigantic. It's by the brilliantly named, unforgettable Roddy Bottom. Honestly, Roddy Bottom. He makes lovely music, though. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.